So now it's my turn to talk, and we're going to switch very much to the area of education and looking at how well we teach and evaluate health literacy communication skills. So, and I'm talking as a member, a scholar in residence of the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education. Have no relationships to disclose. What do we know about literacy in healthcare? We know that patients' low literacy is linked to less health knowledge, poorer health behavior, poorer outcomes, poorer navigation skills. We know the majority of U.S. adults struggle with health information and tasks, and we know the demands and expectations of the healthcare system are increasing, so this is going to be an increasing problem for the future. When we started studying health literacy, we were looking at it more as a patient deficit. And the skills and ability of the patient. Now we're looking at the demands and complexity of health information as these clash together, and what can we do from the health system point of view to make things better. The Institute of Medicine reports, we've talked about, I wanted to mention the Joint Commission 2007 report, that patients must be given information that they understand that health literacy is a patient's safety issue. So what does that mean? It means all clinicians need health literacy communication skills. And we can talk about health literate organizations, and we can talk about health literate written information, but the burden falls today on every clinician, physicians, nurses, social workers, whoever, to improve their own written and oral communication skills to ensure that their patients can fully understand and act on the healthcare information that they need to safely care for themselves. There's an individual responsibility of all health professionals. How effective is the way we teach this? What do we teach, first of all? And how do we evaluate whether our students have learned the communication skills that they're going to need to meet the demand of the patients to be sure that the patients can fully understand? So I'm going to look just at this point at physicians and at graduate physicians, at residents in training. There are over 9,000 individual residency programs in the United States and over 121,000 residents in training in any year. The Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education is a private nonprofit organization that reviews and accredits all of these programs and the institutions that sponsor them. So a little bit about the ACGME mission. We say, we improve healthcare and population health by assessing and advancing the quality of resident physician education through accreditation. And the strategic priorities, the first one is to increase accreditation emphasis on educational outcomes. This is a big change that we're seeing all through healthcare and many other areas, moving away from time-based criteria of what's a good program and a good curriculum. You have 3 hours of instruction on X, you have 2 weeks in a rotation. Instead of that, we're looking at what are the competencies that your graduates are going to demonstrate when they go out for an independent practice, and how are you going to achieve those competencies. This has been a radical change in the way educators have been talking 20 years or 30 years more as they've been working on this, but they're it's now through all of their discussion, and that's what I'm going to talk a little bit about, how that helps innovation and particularly how that helps define some of the things that are important for health literacy communication skills. So the job strategic priority is to the emphasis on educational outcomes, providing a structured approach to evaluate the competency of all residents, and also to foster innovation and improvement in the learning environment. And we've always had a vision of accreditation keeping things the way they were. It's good the way they are, keep them the same. Instead, accreditation is moving to a much more quality improvement, constant improvement methodology. So how did we get to competencies? Well, probably 15 years of work on the American Board of Medical Specialties and ACGME finally agreed that there were 6 main competencies that all specialties in medicine needed to demonstrate in order to be competent, proficient, practicing independent physicians. And those are medical knowledge, patient care, interpersonal communication skills, professionalism, problem-based learning and improvement, and system-based practice. Well, even setting them out like that, that was a shock to many people in the field, and many of the program directors, now that I'm at ACGME, have said to me, well, medical knowledge, we know about that. That's what we test. That's what the board certification exams are. That's what the USMLE exams are. That also tests patient knowledge, patient care, and we also see that in the hospital and in our records. But those last four are kind of squishy things. We don't know what they are or how to evaluate them. How do you evaluate communication skills? How do you evaluate professionalism? Okay, we say, you know, always put the patient first, interest first above self-interest, honesty, integrity, et cetera. How do you evaluate that? What are you looking for? To say nothing of the quality improvement ideas and the system-based practice. How do you work in the system? So these were adopted in 98 and became part of the accreditation process in 2002. And all of the program directors around the country started to say, it's all very nice, but we don't know how to do this. Give us some help. And starting in 2010, they came up, oh, this is just why we're moving towards competency-based education. And a lot of that is because we're in a world in which the healthcare system is changing constantly and is demanding outcomes of and competency of all of the health professionals. So they need a roadmap, something more concrete. And so it was developed in 2010, the concept of milestones as a roadmap to competencies. Milestones describe performance levels residents are expected to demonstrate for skills, knowledge, behaviors in the six competency domains. And milestones lay out a framework of observable behaviors and other attributes that are associated with the residents' development as physicians. And there's a system set up where they will be evaluated every 6 months. So the concept of milestones, yes, they're observable behaviors, and yes, they're developmental. And there are five levels. Level one is where a resident would be on the first day, just after they graduated school, the first day of their residency program. What would you expect to see in the way they would behave? And then level two, they've learned a little more. Level three, more. Level four, they're ready to graduate. Level five are aspirational levels for lifelong learning and improvement. And this is just an example of how they were set out. So this is patient care. One is the competency. The subcompetency is, can they take an appropriate history? Level one, they can do a general medical history. This is for physiatry, PM&R. Level two is they can do a basic physiatric history, including medical, functional, and psychosocial elements. Level three, they can do a comprehensive one, et cetera. And the milestones are specific elements. So by the time they're ready to graduate, they can elicit subtleties and information that may not be readily volunteered by the patient, which means they have to have established such a relationship with the patient and spend time with them, such that the patient feels comfortable in talking about other issues. Well, how did they develop milestones? What happened actually is they got working groups together in every specialty, over 900 volunteers actually to create these over a 2-3 year period. So the working group and the specialty had members of the review committees, which traditionally set up the curricula that ACGME would then evaluate when they did site visits. Certification boards would have representatives, program directors from each of the training programs, or some of the training programs, residents and fellows, and members of the specialty societies. And they also had advisory groups. So you have these large groups, people representing different points of view in the education world coming together and trying to decide what should these milestones be. They all began the same way, reviewing available documents, program requirements, certification exam outlines, competency statements, national curricula, and milestones from other specialties. Lots of brainstorming, lots of drafting, lots of rejecting. If you've ever been on any one of these consensus committees, you know that they come up with loads of ideas that then have to be winnowed down to what may be accurate, what everybody can agree on. In part of that agreement process, not only did it have to be approved by the advisory group, but they did a survey of program directors. Could you live with these if these are milestones? Could you use them? Are these appropriate kind of questions? And final edits and publication. They started collecting information on the milestones, I think, in 2014. This year, there's been a full year now of collecting information on them. So interpersonal and communication skills. The competency is a core competency requirement for all specialties. Reads, communicates effectively with patients and families with diverse socioeconomic and cultural backgrounds. Okay. What does that mean, and how do you define that into milestones? So 7 of the 26 major specialties included health literacy concepts in the milestones that they developed for this one competency. Individual wording, different levels of experience, completely independently, apparently in the groups that they got together to analyze the problem, there was a health literacy advocate who spoke up and got the words in, right? How come? Okay, just interesting process. So I want you to see a couple of these. This is general surgery. General surgery says that the surgical resident coming in the first year should be fully competent in health literacy communication skills, okay? So at level one, this resident uses a variety of techniques to ensure that communication with patients and their families is understandable and respectful. In other words, non-technical language, using a teach back, appropriate pacing, small pieces of information, okay? They expect a lot from the medical school to be able to get to that point. So that's general surgery. Now, physical medicine and rehab, for the same competency, put the health literacy things at level 3. Level 2 utilizes effective verbal and nonverbal communication strategies, including active listening, augmentative communication devices, interpreters, taking a look at all of the kind of communication needs of the patients. But level 3 is effectively educates and counsels patients and families, utilizing strategies to ensure understanding. In other words, teach back. So they expect this to be developed over time, as opposed to the surgery that thinks it's all going to be developed before they even get to residency. Family medicine put it at a level 2, and just throws matches modality of communication to patient needs, health literacy, and context. And then here's urology. Which is probably the most interesting, basic patient and family interpersonal communication skills. And urology starts all of their milestones sort of the same way. So level 1 is you know the importance of it. Level 2, you can show this skill in basic ways in simple situations. Level 3, you're doing it in more complex situations. Level 4, you're consistently using this skill at all times. And then their examples are, the physician, one, listens actively, in other words, allows the patient to tell his or her story or to provide his or her perspective, does not interrupt and talk over. Level 2, these are examples, this is what you're looking for, what you should be able to see as you watch the resident care for patients. When explaining, presents small chunks of information at a time, avoids use of technical medical words, paces speech appropriately, not too fast. 3, ensures that his or her message was understood. In other words, when applicable, the patient can repeat, summarize treatment options. The patient can describe signs that would signal a need to contact the physician. The patient can repeat home care instructions. The 4th point was respond supportively and empathetically to patients' emotions and concerns. So someone on that urology committee was a very strong advocate for communication skills and for health literacy. Don't know who. What are the benefits of milestone assessments? Primarily benefits for the residents, because for the first time they have explicit expectations. So for everybody who thought that these were kind of squishy requirements, how do we deal with them? How do we think about them? They now have a kind of a map of what to look for in the behaviors that they're going to see. It identifies areas to work on, gives them much more feedback from the faculty members, and identifies underperformers. Other benefits are for the program. It can guide curricular development, early identification of underperformers, and their benefits for the public too. So how is it determined there is a clinical competency committee? Feeling was that these are still very subjective analysis of what the residents are doing. So the more eyes we have looking at them, it's a group of faculty members who evaluate often six or seven faculty. They may be in the same specialty or related ones. They may be in allied health fields. They may be in nursing or social work. There may be evaluations by patients and families, peers, and others, all put together and analyzed. And so here's the clinical competency committee. And here's just a way of looking at all the possible kinds of evaluations. I'm sorry that all the letters got scattered to try to read them, but you're looking at using standardized patients, using peer evaluations, nursing evaluations, end of rotation evaluations, simulation labs, self-evaluations, patient family evaluations, all coming into the assessment of milestones. So this is the new world in accreditation. Continuous observations identify opportunities for improvement. The program makes improvements. It assesses those improvements, continues with continuous observations, and we have a very innovative new way of looking at education. So, to promote innovation, yes. So, that's all I'm going to talk about, and I open for questions. And
I'll try to listen.
He's a very loud voice, we can't hear you.
This is partly to you, too. So, Alice, what do you think about this approach for dentistry to go to a mandated certification for health literacy? And Joanne, what does it take to get more than 7 out of 26 to sign up? That was my outside voice.
How's that?
You're first.
No, you first.
Okay, so I guess what I would think is I think it would be, you know, really pushing the boulder uphill, trying to get it done. But I believe it's one that we need to start pushing. And there's a little bit of interest in academia and dentistry. The biggest difference is, you know, in dentistry, there aren't the almost mandatory residencies that there are in medicine, and specifically not for a longer time. Like a lot of general residencies are only 1 year, 2 years kind of thing. Surgery, ortho would be longer, but the other thing is, I guess, I would, to be honest, prefer to see it at the undergraduate level, that we have to do it, especially in dentistry, because we don't have the residencies. And it needs to be in all of the places. And I think it's just barely being able, getting a foothold into dental schools at all, and dental hygiene schools, which are very important.
Well, you can see from the surgeons believed it should all be in the medical school arena.
I don't think all, but
so,
I think it has
but
to start
something there. Certainly has to be started there, and probably is. You'd be surprised. You talk to medical students; they've heard the terms health literacy. Nursing students: oh, yes, we have that in the course. What did they teach you? Well, that's another question as you get into it a little bit more deeply. This is looking at how would you evaluate whether it now is part of your practice. Whether it is so internalized that you are consistently able to not only speak in a way that patients can understand, but kind of judge whether they're understanding and ask them indeed to summarize, to teach back, and get a feel of how that is done. It takes a lot of practice to do that. It's just interesting that so many of them are thinking that it should be possible to see that by the time they're ready to graduate and go into practice. 7 out of 26 anyway think that you should be able to do that. So, yeah. But you have to speak up because I can't hear.
I'm in nursing, and my question is if you've seen anybody proposing kind of an interdisciplinary training model. I know that some schools of nursing are going in that direction for some coursework to have interdisciplinary classwork in the health sciences between disciplines. And I think that this to coordinate a course like that or a logical course. So
right.
Have you seen any curriculum?
I don't know of any such courses, but it seems like a logical place to go. Yeah. Should work. Maybe next year we'll hear more about that.
Yeah,
Can I just add one thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I'm I'll just yell. Can you all hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a pretty good room for acoustics. So I have two Schertel relatives who are both fourth-year medical students. One's in Virginia, the other one's at the University of Maryland, where I live. Neither one of them has ever had a course in communication skills. They're getting ready to go out into their residencies. And until I brought it up, none of them had ever heard the terms health literacy. So I think you are around better schools than I am. But it's something that we have to do a lot, all of us in this room, and especially when we're in academia. If you are in, for example, in the School of Public Health, you have dynamite chance of being able to get into medical, nursing, pharmacy, get into dental school. I mean, it's a wide open opportunity, I think, to work. And so we're going to watch you and see what all you're doing.
Remember, this is watching 9,000 programs and what people, what their aspirations are. Basically, when they set up the competencies and the milestones, these are dreams of what we think we're teaching, right? And in this first year, what they're finding as they're trying to look at the information they're getting is, gee, maybe we're graduating these residents and they haven't quite met that level 4 milestone in many of the specialties. So this is the very beginning of trying to look at this and judge. This is aspirationally where we want to go, what are we really doing, and how much are we actually teaching? Then that piece of it comes next. So we're going to see. But anyway, it's a start, and I thought you'd be interested in hearing.
I think it's very exciting, and I think we're going to get into more of this with the ACA because they're going to demand more of this, and I think it's particularly important with when we look at the revolving door, where patients, frequently low income but not always, who have chronic diseases, heart disease, diabetes, and they're sent home from the hospital, and they're back in again. This is the revolving door. Back in 30 to 60 days, and soon, if not already, the hospitals are not going to get reimbursed for that. And I think that's good. I think that's going to be used for leverage to make us increase literacy, because there's no reason why that patient or that caregiver can't be given appropriate information of how to take care of this patient, how to keep this patient back in the hospital. We can do that.